Welcome to the CenturyLink Labs podcast with your host, Lucas Carlson. From Docker and Linux containers to programming languages and web frameworks, we interview technology and thought leaders around the world every week. This week's interview is brought to you by CenturyLink Cloud, the world's fastest self-service enterprise-grade cloud.
Hello, this is Lucas Carlson from CenturyLink Labs podcast, and this week we've got a really special guest for you, James Turnbull, and he's special not just because he works as a vice president at Docker doing services and support stuff, but he's also special because he wrote the book on Docker, and it just came out. It's called The Docker Book. So of all the people in the universe who I would want to talk to and get their opinion about Docker and ask questions of, James is kind of the authoritative figure right now, and so I'm really excited to pick his brain, ask him about some stuff, see what he thinks about technology, where it's going. So James, can you tell us a little bit about your background, where you come from, where you've worked before?
Sure. I've been in the IT industry far too long. It's coming up on 20 years. I largely started off in the mainframe world. So I worked in a big mainframe shop. And then I worked on mid-range systems, and sort of along came client server and Linux and things like that. And I got excited by that and did a sort of a bunch of things in there. I've been a systems programmer. I've been a sysadmin. I've been a security guy. I've been a very bad developer. A bunch of other things. I've been an operator, and back in the bad old days when operations meant piles of printouts would appear in the morning out of a mainframe, and you would deliver them to departments. And in the last few years, I've primarily focused on startups and really looking at open source software and how to monetize it and how to make a business out of it.
Awesome. So the Docker book isn't actually your first book. You've written like 6 or 7 books. Is that right? What else have you written about?
7 books, I think. I wrote a book last year about Logstash, which is an open source log management tool that really excites me. I've always been very passionate about log management, which probably makes me a very boring human being. But this Logstash was I would call it an open source contender with Splunk, and with the tool I've just released, Kibana, last year. Just sort of a console for Logstash. If you're an open source heavy shop and you're good at that sort of stuff, I would strongly look at how people suggest you look at it instead of, say, something like Splunk. And it's certainly a lot cheaper. Before that, I wrote a couple of books about Puppet. I was very heavily involved in Puppet Labs, one of the early employees there and one of the original engineers on Puppet. I was involved in that sort of reasonably early piece, 2007 or so. And some books about Linux security, Linux sysadministration, and monitoring.
Awesome. So I really enjoyed the Docker book, and for anyone listening, you can go to the dockerbook.com, is that right?
That's correct.
So
dockerbook.com, there's no dot.
Okay, just dockerbook.com. It was a really, really well-written book, I can't recommend it enough for people getting into Docker or have been in and want to learn more about it. I really enjoyed kind of some of the early chapters discussing the history of containers, why they came about, and kind of, they have a storied history. They've been around for a long time. They're just recently becoming popular. Can you kind of tell us more about containers and their history?
Sure. So I think most people are aware of sort of hypervisor virtualization, which is sort of VMware stock in trade, where you run a hypervisor that sort of disintermediates you from the underlying hardware, provides like virtual hardware, that's been sort of the probably since the early mid 2000s, that's been sort of the predominant sort of virtualization. But there's a long history of what I call operating system level virtualization, which is essentially where your operating system features the operating system used to create sort of virtual walls. So instead of this massive sort of hypervisor layer in the middle, you are directly talking to the hardware on top of the operating system, through the operating system's own APIs. Probably one of the first examples of this is probably IBM came out with some logical partitioning products that sort of ran on ZOS and OS 400, which is sort of mainframe and mid-range systems. And probably the platform that most people sort of remember, if they're sort of old like me, is Solaris Zones, which was a similar sort of model produced for Solaris. And for those people who are Solaris people, a lot of them are deeply passionate about Zones, and you'll come across a lot of people who continue to talk about the thing that Zones was the best thing since sliced bread. And you'll find them coming along, particularly to Docker meetups, and going, "I remember, young man, when Solaris Zones were around, and they were so much better. Why can't you? What, you guys are not new." And we clearly acknowledge the heritage because, you know, a lot of the things about Zones you'll see sort of modeled in some of the stuff we've done with Docker. But even in the Linux world, there's a reasonably strong history of containers. Originally, Docker was based on a project called LXC, which is essentially Linux containers. And that's been around for quite some time in various forms. It sort of reached a 1.0 release not that long ago, last year maybe. I think, and a lot of shops heavily use Linux LXC containers. You know, Google's a good example of that. Early on, they moved to their own container format. But you know, if you go to a lot of web shops, particularly things like places like Etsy and things like that, Facebook's another good example. You'll see a lot of Linux containers in operation. The big challenge for them, the big challenge for Linux containers, and probably one of the reasons it hasn't been popular up until now, is that they're not easy to use. LXC really requires reasonably savvy engineers to actually build. They're not simple. They don't have a really simple API, and they certainly don't have a really simple user interface. So one of the things that we looked at when we first built Docker was, you know, why haven't containers been so popular? They're really useful. They're really fast. Why aren't people all over this? And Solomon Hikes, who's our benevolent dictator, looked at it and said, well, the key problem is, you know, it's not easy to interact with it. So what we're going to do is we'll take the technologies these containers use, and originally LXC, but now we've built our own format called libcontainer, and we'll wrap an API around that, and we'll abstract away all of the stuff, the complexity that previously made it hard for people to use. And then next to that, we'll build a workflow. So we'll build a way that you can actually build around those containers. So our containers are based on a concept called images, which is essentially a collection of, it's like a virtual machine. Essentially, you're building an image that you build the container from. So you might have a Node.js image that contains your Node.js stack, and then you launch containers from that image. So we build a workflow that allows you to have those images and allows you to build containers from them, and then sort of in a sort of virtuous developer-centric circle. So a developer can have, I'm going to build my image, my Node.js image, I'm going to add my Node.js code, I'm going to run my containers from that and do my testing, and then when I'm done, I can take my image and I can move that somewhere else. So I can say I can move it into my Jenkins environment and launch containers from it to run my Jenkins tests in it. Then I can move that image into production, and then I can deploy my production containers from it. And that sort of made Docker a much more seamless experience. Certainly a much less frictionful experience.
Got it. So given that it's a less frictionful experience and they are making it simpler to use, and it's a really popular thing and it seems like it's taking off everywhere, does this mean that Linux containers are going to replace virtual machines?
I think they're going to replace virtual machines in some cases. I don't think I'm being very controversial about that. I think VMware acknowledges that the virtual machine as a unit of compute is not ideal for all circumstances. And I think the classic example is probably platform as a service or even infrastructure as a service, like things like the OpenStack project. Virtual machines are still a little bit unwieldy, that they do take a lot of storage space. They do take some time to boot up. And they do take some time to destroy. So if you're thinking about things in the platform in the IaaS world, a big part of the value add you offer your customers is that it's really fast. So you say, I it's a black box service I want to offer to my developers. I want them to be able to say, here's a copy of the production application stack. that I can use to develop and test my application, and I want it now. I don't want to wait 2 hours for it to spin up all of these machines. I don't even want to wait 5 minutes for it to spin up all these machines. So can most Docker containers launch have a sub-second launch time? So I can launch 10 Docker containers that represent my production stack in less than a second. And from that sort of immediate availability point of view, I think that's really attractive. And it's something that as developers get used to having that on demand, it's very hard to make them go back to a couple of minute launch time for a virtual machine. I think also certain types of workloads, the HPC world, high performance computing world, virtual machines don't make a lot of sense. Whereas containers, being fast and agile and with a really fast lifecycle, do make a lot of sense. Similarly with immutable infrastructure. Things like, I have a farm full of static web instances, or I have a series of very similar instances, a farm of WordPress sites or something like that, then where there's a limited amount of change and where it's actually cheaper to destroy the container and restart it than it is to sort of build a whole container and then manage it. Those sort of short-lived sort of workloads, I think containers are very attractive. I don't think you could say that all workloads belong in containers right now, both from a sort of a security standpoint. Containers are a little bit more lightweight from a security perspective, that represent the same barriers between that virtual machines do. And also from an orchestration and management point of view. VMware certainly, you take a tool, something like ESX and the various management tools built on top of that, things like vMotion and VCAC, and virtual storage and all sorts of stuff, VMware certainly have a much stronger management and orchestration story than anyone in the container world. That's not to say we're not catching up with them, but at the moment, if you're doing very sophisticated things with containers, you will have to do a bit of jury rigging and a bit of building your own infrastructure around that until we release some more features and functionality.
Got it. So you used to work at Puppet, and so you've had a very long history with the DevOps concept. How is Docker changing the concept of DevOps fundamentally?
I think that I know that Docker's changing DevOps so much as accelerating it. I think one of the big things about DevOps was about that life cycle between a developer builds an application and then hands it over to an operations team, and in classic DevOps examples, usually they throw that code over the fence, they go to the pub, and the operations team goes, we have to run this thing now, and it turns out that they've built it on a version of the JVM that doesn't run in production, or they've included a bunch of node modules that no one in operations know how they work, no one's considered security or monitoring or backups or performance analysis or capacity planning, any of that sort of stuff. And so operations says, I hate the development team, they've given me another piece of shit to run. So Docker was kind of built around the concept of, I want to be able to deploy an image in my development environment that looks as much as possible like how it's going to look like in production, and I want to be really fast to build that image, and I want it to be really easy to spin up containers from that image and work on them and develop from them. And I think some of that stuff appeared in the DevOps world through Mitchell Hashimoto's Vagrant tool, but it's still VirtualBox, and VMware Fusion. It's still virtual machines. It's not fast, and certainly virtual the boxes, the Vagrant boxes you built were still fairly large objects and constructs and hard to move around. So I think Docker provides sort of the same sort of enhancement where developers get to work on their code in a Docker environment that looks like production. When they hand it over to operations knows they've built using an image that is something that operations can introspect and go, they've built using their production image. I'm pretty sure this application is going to run in a Docker container in production the same way it ran in a Docker container in development. And given the fact that it is so lightweight and so fast to build those images in those containers, you reduce the cycle time between developer writes code and code is available to run in production, all of which are sort of make that DevOps sort of virtuous cycle much faster.
Got it. Really interesting. I think that makes a lot of sense. So another trend that I've been seeing is the CoreOS trend has been about minimalizing the Linux distribution that Docker runs on, taking out all the unnecessary, you know, taking apt-get out, taking out all of the binaries that aren't necessary anymore, because if you just containerize stuff, the containers can have all the binaries in them. So stripping the Docker host down to bare minimums is one thing that I've been seeing. But on the other side, I've also been seeing a trend of minimizing the containers themselves, minimizing the things running within Docker. This is something that we talked about with Colin Humphreys just a week ago on this podcast. Have you been noticing this trend of minimalizing, stripping bare the inside of your containers? And can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I think there's sort of three things that work there. The first around the sort of CoS sort of model, like just enough operating system. If you're running just Docker containers on top of an operating system, then if you have the bare minimum required to run that, not only is it more performant, but you reduce the attack surface. It's hopefully more secure as a result. And if I was a service provider, I would leap all over something like CoreOS. I mean, like it's like a, you know, it's cheap, it's open source. You know, it's really focused on doing one thing really well versus an operating system, a full operating system, which really has to try and do lots of things really well. But on the container side of things, which I think is more interesting, I think there's two things at work. One is that there is a move towards, you know, stripping down what actually runs in the container. And I think this is actually something that will be really interesting. What happens is that sort of distros and operating systems, if you look at it, the differences between them are not huge. Like you know, you have apt-get in the Ubuntu world, and you have yum in the Red Hat world. Red Hat certainly certifies applications to run on RHEL, but broadly speaking, the same source code generally runs all of those utilities and binaries and libraries, varying versions, but broadly speaking, the same sort of material. I think we're going to see a lessening of the importance of the operating system, and more a focus on the relevant components you need to run specific services, and you know. Particularly a good example of this is the sort of the second, I guess the third part of this, which is sort of that lean towards microservices that I think you were sort of hinting at with Colin's discussion, is that Docker containers, we recommend Docker containers to. I think the third part of this is really really related to sort of microservices. We recommend that you run one thing in each Docker container. So if you have think about an application stack, we say you should run an Apache process, a single Apache process in a single container. And then run a single MySQL process in a single container, and then hook those containers together. And there's a couple of reasons we recommend this. One is I think that the microservices architecture is really healthy. It's a really good model for a lot of organizations. It's really simple to debug. It's really simple to scale. It's really simple to understand what's happening. It's really simple how to understand the relationships between your applications. Rather than a model where you have a single virtual machine or a single physical server that you're running 10 services on that all have interaction issues potentially, or all have, when you try to debug, certainly you've got to understand their interaction potential. There's multiple places you need to go and look to see if you can find out what the problem is. You know, anytime you want to actually start scale out an application like that, often you have to break those physical or virtual machines and the services on them into pieces anyway. Like, okay, I used to run my WordPress instance with Apache and PHP and Nginx, PHP and MySQL on a single machine. Now I'd like to pull the MySQL server out. All of a sudden I need to actually, you know, do a bunch of rejigging to my architecture and, you know, punch holes in firewalls and, you know, configure another host with a whole operating system on it just to run MySQL, and then I have to get the port right and all that sort of stuff, harden two boxes, patch two boxes. I think that sort of microservices model is very attractive, and it's one of the sort of forces that sort of, I think, I wasn't expecting to see Docker change, but as soon as people started talking about it, they were like, well, I wanted to do a microservices thing, or I wanted to do a services-oriented architecture, and Docker just basically forced me to do it anyway, so I was like, investment for free. And so I'm really excited to see that. I hadn't anticipated that at all, but more and more companies I'm talking to are like, this is awesome. This finally gives us the reason to try and break our services in, you know, our applications into a more service-oriented model.
Yeah, in one of the blog posts that I've read recently, I'll link to it in the show notes. I've actually seen people experimenting, stripping down their containers to the point where they've created an application, they've compiled it into, it might be a Go application that they compile down to a single binary, and they make the container kind of, basically the entire container just has one binary in it, which is your application. Yep. There's basically no attack vectors besides a kernel exploit and the application code, obviously, but there's no external factors.
And also, there's nothing interfering with its performance. There's nothing. It's like it's really easy to model. It's really easy to understand what's going on and trace it. And yeah, there's no weird interactions or potential for other things to get in the way. I think that stuff's just awesome.
Yeah, it's like basically you get your slash bin and your slash user bin on your host machine and your container itself, and make sure obviously Docker is running. Your container just runs a single binary compiled Go application, and it's like there's just nothing but application there. I think that's so cool.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's really interesting, and we're seeing some lot of people in the Scala world and people in Clojure world are also. The JVM is an awesome tool, but it can be a little bit temperamental. You can run the JVM inside a container, and you are guaranteed that its sole thing that is running is the JVM. There's plenty of ways to JMX and other things to instrument tool things like that. Where it's entirely focused on performing one function, and it's not constrained by or you can't have the discussion of it's a JVM. Therefore, its performance interaction with some other thing, or its behavioral interaction with some other thing, is a problem. Makes that something much cleaner. I like the idea a lot.
Got it. So you're really on the front line for a lot of Docker use cases. You're right there in charge of support for Docker. So you really see the good, the bad, the ugly. Can you tell us about the good? How are big companies, enterprises adopting Docker? Where is kind of the lowest hanging fruit for people who haven't used Docker yet to say, I should consider Dockerizing this kind of thing as a toe in the water for Docker. Where should people get started?
Sure, we're seeing two sort of major entry points. The first one is what we're describing as hyperscale. It's where people have they have large virtual machine environments and they're their jobs basically revolve around, I have $100,000 worth of servers, I want to pack as much workload as possible onto those servers, and virtual machines with the hypervisor running, I lose 10-20% of the machines in hypervisor performance. If I rip the hypervisor out and replace it with the Docker host, that percentage goes down to about 1 or 2%, which means that I can pack more workloads onto a single machine. That's one sort of entry point, and we're seeing that a lot in large financials. We're obviously very cost conscious. The other entry point is really very developer centric, and we're seeing people like, I like the workflow, I like the fact that it helps me test my code, I like the fact that the code I produce at the end is something that operations is going to be happy to run because it looks like the things that it's been run on, the things they run on. And it helps me build faster and test faster and deploy faster. But interestingly, we're seeing sort of crossover both ways. So we're seeing infrastructure teams will deploy this Docker thing and an application development team will hear about it and they'll start saying, well, we could use that and we could use that as part of our dev test build cycle and that would be awesome. And the infrastructure team says, oh, okay, you want to use one of our tools? And most of these big financials and things like that, the infrastructure teams are not used to the app dev teams actually coming to them and saying, can we use one of your tools? Normally they're saying, here is a tool, and the app dev team says, yep, that sucks. We're not going to use that. It's going to make our life miserable. I spent 5 or 6 years trying to sell Puppet to people, and Puppet traditionally is something that application developers are not very keen on. Sysadmins love it. Sysadmins think it's an awesome tool. Application developers think about it as another language they have to learn. With Docker, I'm seeing this weird thing where both groups are sort of happy with the tool and both groups want to adopt it. And I see it in meetings where it's the first time two teams are sitting in the same room trying to procure the same product together. It's really weird. Sort of usually I'm having to sell one or the other on it, or I'm having to sort of mediate an argument between an app dev group and an infrastructure group. And then instead, in this case, I'm sort of answering questions, sort of different tangents. Obviously, the operations people are interested in you know, how it runs and how you run it and what the performance characteristics are. And when the app developers are interested in sort of like the workflow and how I fit it into my life cycle and how I build it into Jenkins or use it with Git or... But, you know, they're essentially talking about the same tool that they both inherently want to buy, and that's really cool.
Awesome. So then let's talk about the bad and ugly. What are the biggest challenges you see in adopting Docker today? Stuff that, you know, might be fixed in a year or two, but right now is a rough edge.
I think probably the big things now are sort of missing features. I think the product is relatively stable, and I'm actually really impressed by how far we've come in a relatively short period of time to stabilize things. The 1.0 release was really, you know, last the couple of dot releases before that focused on quality, and I've not seen there really hasn't been a massive influx of bugs despite it being used. Now it's gone 1.0, the use has exploded, but we really haven't had a corresponding increase in like people finding bugs, which really makes me feel happy about the amount we've focused on quality. But I do think there are a few things right now, particularly if you're doing you know, multiple container application stacks or cross geographical region applications or applications that are sort of distributed. You know, Docker is very much a host-centric tool right now. You run one Docker host, it doesn't really talk to another Docker host. You have to add sort of more special sauce to do things like orchestration and service discovery, to do things like trust and stuff like that. So they're all things that I think are missing from our story that are being developed at the moment, and we're really excited by the fact that we introduced sort of libswarm, which is a very low-level library, sort of primitives, that's designed to do some of that orchestration stuff. We just acquired the Orchard team, who have a tool called Fig, which is a really amazing sort of application stack builder for Docker, and we're really excited to be able to add that to Docker, and you'll see a bunch of integration coming in the next month or so for that. And then we've seen this huge explosion of ecosystem stuff. So the CoreOS team have things like Fleet in ECTD. The Mesosphere team support Docker and intend to do a bunch of other support there. Kubernetes, which is a Google project. IBM's adding Docker support into the Pivotal Labs, into the Cloud Foundry product. It's an open stack. There's a bunch of tooling and sort of stuff around this that's sort of really exploded, and it's made it a lot easier for people to be able to sort of knock some of the rough edges off Docker. That's not to say there aren't still some. Like, I think people would like networking to be more flexible, logging to be better and easy to use. The way we link Docker containers together, I think there's a bunch of work we need to do around that to make that more sophisticated. All of which are either, at the moment, I'm really happy to say, are either in pull requests being reviewed right now or are in design. So I'm expecting most of those sort of the major rough edges to be removed in the next, I guess, 1 to 2 months. And I expect the 1.2, 1.3 releases, as they go out, you'll see some pretty impressive sort of native features that'll allow you to do some pretty awesome stuff with Docker.
That's very exciting to hear about. So I want to go off on a slight tangent because you've been blogging for many years, and I've been enjoying one of my favorite posts that you did was a blog that was ranting about technical recruiters, what they do wrong, like how horrible it is. Anybody who's been working as a programmer or an ops guy in the field knows, has gotten these emails from technical recruiters that are just so terrible. And you just went off on it, and I loved it. Have you, since writing that, have you ever been technically recruited and have a good story, or did you just keep getting bad ones?
For a while, I've been responding to tech recruiters and actually like doing grammar corrections or like telling them, rewriting their email the way I would want to see it. But after a while, that became very time-consuming, even after having two or three templates, because they all have two or three templates. So I gave up because they don't seem to learn, and the turnover in the tech recruiting industry is so high. Every now and again, I think my rough statistics, and I keep a rough count of things, about 1 in 100 of the recruiting emails I get is one that I go, someone's got a clue. And I talk a bit about in the post about what's really important about what you want to see. And I think, you know, the message for me is like you want to be... where did the person find you? What precisely is the job they're looking for? They're looking at you for what's the company? Why you're a good fit, and not just because I saw your LinkedIn profile and think you're a good fit. They've actually done some research. Like, I saw the fact you contributed code to the Logstash project, and I saw the fact that you worked in the security industry and wrote a book about Linux. And I saw that you worked at Puppet Labs and Docker. Like, someone's actually gone a bit of trouble to actually learn a bit about you, or that sort of stuff. And then really clear definition of what the role involves. I think too many of it's like, would you like to be a full stack engineer? And I'm like, what the hell does that mean? Does that mean you want me to work on front end, back end, and some other stuff? We want you to be a Rails developer. Well, there's lots of different Rails developers. There's people who are deep in the guts of front end. There are people who are deep in the guts of Active Record. You need to be able to say, you'll be doing this, leading this team. These are the technical challenges, and we want to grow the team out. And lastly, more importantly, and most importantly to me, is like, it's really clear about what the package looks like. It's like, we want to pay you this much money. You're going to get some options. You're going to have benefits that look like this. Here's a bit about our working environment. I think those are really critical things. Like, I'm not going to respond to someone who says, we're looking to hire somebody, an engineer, to do X, because that could be anything to me. And I certainly don't want to have two conversations or three conversations or a multiple exchange of emails that takes up my time to discover that the company wants to pay me $60,000 a year. If that's not what I want to earn, then I've just wasted a bunch of time where I could have been level set just straight from day one.
And have you ever gotten an email from a recruiter that was?
I have one. I had one example a couple of months ago that actually was like, here's the company. The founder went and looked at your stuff, and he came to one of your talks. And it was like the founder specifically wanted to mention this point in the talk that he thought was really interesting, which actually wasn't on the slide, so I knew he must have been there. This is what we want to pay, this is what we're looking for, this is how we want to grow the team, this is why we think you're the right person. Sadly, it wasn't in a domain I was particularly interested in, but had it been, I certainly would have been predisposed to reaching out to that person. And in fact, I did reply to them and recommend several people to them, because I thought that's actually someone who's taken the time to think about this and produce something. But that's like, as I said, 1 in 100, I mean, that's pretty close to that sort of strike rate. Most of the ones I get are, dear insert name here, and I'm not joking, I do see insert name here quite frequently. We would like to, we have a job going as a senior Rails engineer in Raleigh, and I'm like, okay, I'm not going to respond to that, I'm just going to delete it. And I think recruiters need to really learn this, they need to really get better at this, because otherwise, the spam effect, it's not going to attract the right people. They're not going to get referrals, and it's not going to be quality.
Yeah, it seems like there's a big opportunity for technical recruiting to get it right.
So I will throw in the Lever guys in San Francisco are building an applicant tracking system that I really like, and they seem to have their heads really screwed on right, and actually thinking about how people communicate with candidates, and there are some people actually thinking about building tools in this space. Just sadly, there are humans in there that aren't so good at the other parts of it.
Yeah, so you work at a company that is in charge of one of the most popular open source projects in history. So much stuff has happened with this project in the last 15, 16 months that like would have taken 5 years, 10 years, 20 years in the past. It's just been compressed. It's just super popular. And what is it like? What's it like working at Docker? What's the culture like? How does it feel for the audience that is watching from the sidelines? Can you give us a taste, a flavor of it?
Sure. I think busy is probably the first thing that springs to mind. Up until recently, we didn't really have a commercial sort of product lines. We were very much focused on the dot cloud, the sort of the previous PaaS we used to run. We've just sold that a couple of days ago. And the open source project, and they're all sort of disparate sort of things. I think the thing that's really come together over the last sort of 6 to 8 months has been that everybody is like, okay, we now there's Docker, and Docker's sort of a, you know, an engine or a platform that enables people to do this cool stuff with the containers and has this cool workflow. And then we've built the Docker Hub, which is sort of the software as a service that helps you manage your Docker images and helps you manage your Docker workflow. And then we've added some sort of commercial services to monetize things on the side. And as a result of that, everybody in the team is sort of like, oh, we have to talk to one another, and we have to actually, we have to actually have there's a strong sense of collaboration across the team. And I think that would have been only possible because of our open source sort of heritage. And we kind of treat as much of the company as possible in that same sort of open source sort of way, which is, you know, open it up to people, let people have a conversation about it, design in public, transparent by default for a lot of the things that we build and we talk about and we do. And I think that makes a real difference that you know, people who are, you know, I get, you know, when we first developed our training program, I threw it open for the entire engineering team to sort of go, tell us whether we've got this right. Would you learn how to use Docker using this? And they provided a huge amount of really valuable feedback about, no, Docker doesn't quite work that way. If you tell people like this, it's subtly sort of wrong, and in ways that you wouldn't expect engineers to sort of be able to do. And I think they saw really clearly as a result, look at this hackish workaround they've come up with, because our code doesn't do the right, we should fix that. And that's a really exciting sort of feeling to be in a group where, I can come back from a customer and go, look, they're really upset about all this stuff, and the engineers go, yeah, okay, how will we solve that problem? Instead of like, yeah, shut up, they're just the customer. And I think that's a very open source sentiment, is that sort of like, someone has reached out, they use our product, they found something wrong with it, or something that's a rough edge, we should do our best to try and fix that. A lot of enterprise companies don't approach it that way. They're like, the customer is always wrong, or the customer can sit in the queue, or the customer's feature request will get to it at some release in some point in time. We have much more of a sort of open, collaborative sort of attitude. And we don't really, because we're not really sort of building a massive commercial tool on top of Docker. Docker is very much focused on being open source and spreading that open source goodness around. We don't really need to hide things from people. And as a result, a lot of our design stuff can be much more public. As a community, sort of as an organization, I think it's a pretty friendly place to work. A large chunk of the original engineering team is French, so that has a certain European flavor to it. And every now and again, I have to wander around the office and tell people they're not allowed to have conversations in French, because it's not fair for us poor ignorant American and Australians who only speak one language and that not very well. It does add a certain French flavor to the place, and we'll be one of the few startups where most of our events revolve around French wine as opposed to craft beer. There's a very strange European tradition I discover, which is when you arrive in the office, you walk around the entire office and shake hands with everyone and say good morning, which is definitely not an American or an Australian sort of tradition, but it's one that actually makes you feel really welcome. When I first started, I'm like, well, these people have come to see me, and they're doing it again today. This is really nice. It's a pretty friendly, happy place to work, and one that, I think we're probably marked by way too much to do and not enough people to do it.
Great. Well, I really appreciate your time. This has been really fascinating, and really looking forward to seeing what's next, and sounds like there's all sorts of great things around the corner, and appreciate your time, appreciate learning from you, and hope to have you back.
Thank you very much, Lucas. It's a pleasure to be here. I had a really great time.
Great.
Thanks for listening to the CenturyLink Labs podcast with Lucas Carlson. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll pass along our web address, CenturyLinkLabs.com, to your friends and colleagues. Be sure to check out our archive section on our website for previous podcasts. This has been a CenturyLink production. Join us next time for another edition of the CenturyLink Labs podcast.